Today, answers matter more than ever before. That's why IBM is helping businesses manage customer questions with Watson Assistant. It's conversational AI designed to work for any industry. Let's put smart to work. Visit ibm.com/Watson Assistant.
All right, so episodes 9 and 10 of The Last Dance are going to air on ESPN this weekend, the fantastic docuseries that we've all been watching for the last month or so. You can get caught up on episodes 1 through 8 on the ESPN app and ESPN On Demand. And somebody that you have seen frequently throughout the entire series, David Folk, Michael Jordan's agent, joining us right now on the Sprint People's Hotline. David, good morning. Thanks for coming on. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
What's up, David? Man, I haven't seen you in... gosh knows how long.
Since Cabo.
That's what I said. I said we're at the one and only in Cabo, and I bumped into David, and we had a conversation, and we talked a little bit, and got some sun. That's a long way. It's a long way from Cabo these days.
Great golf.
Oh, yeah, no question. Obviously, The Last Dance is what everybody's talking about right now. Let me ask you this. Being around Michael for so many years and doing so many deals and being a part of his life and everything that he went through and gone through and established, what was the one thing that was so difficult to get through Michael's head?
You know, that's a really tough question to answer because Michael, incredibly, I'd say, you know, I've had hundreds of clients in my career, literally hundreds. And I've had probably 10 or 12 guys in the Hall of Fame. Michael is an incredibly respectful person off the court. You know, if he met a person who was a doctor, an engineer, an artist, he'd be really intrigued by what made them successful. He'd listen. He's very respectful. And when we started, I was 33 years old. I'd been in the business for 10 years. I started when I was in law school. So I wasn't a rookie. And I'd been the junior agent for Arthur Ashe, who's an internationally renowned, you know, tennis star and humanitarian. I'd worked for Phil Ford from North Carolina, who was the National Player of the Year in 78. Worked for James Worthy of the Lakers, who was the number one pick. So it wasn't like he was the first person, but I was very young. And he was incredibly inquisitive, respectful. You know, we've had disagreements over times. There's times that, you know, I've tried to urge him to do things that he might have been initially reluctant to do. But overall, he was like a dream client. You'd never expect him. He never pulled my chain. You know, the one thing that the public, when they look at athletes, they think you have these prima donna clients, you know, and some dweeby agent who's a lawyer, an accountant, you know, and the guy's pulling this chain. Michael never did that. You know, if he called me and said, hey, it's really something really important, can you come out to Chicago? He did that occasionally, but rarely. He wasn't trying to see. If I could explain why, you know, when I teach, I have my own college up at Syracuse, and when I teach, I always ask the following question. When you watch The Godfather, in the very first Godfather 1, Marlon Brando, and he talks so quietly you could barely hear him, I ask my students, why does he talk so quietly? And they said, well, because Marlon Brando had gauze in his mouth. I said, no. Why does the Godfather talk so quietly? They said, I don't know. I said, because he had all the power. Well, Michael knew that he had all the power. You know, he could ask me to basically do anything. But he was, because he knew he had the power, he was respectful how he used it. And he didn't abuse it. And his loyalty to me over an entire career, you know, we're great friends today. You know, you can't ask, you know, a person to be the way he is if they don't want to be that way.
David, one of the most fascinating aspects to me of, you know, Michael's career was that in his final two seasons, I think he made north of $63 million combined. But prior to that, he was grossly underpaid. As an agent, was this an irritant for you?
Well, here's what happened. You know, when he came out at North Carolina back in the day, and this was, make you laugh, Keyshawn, but in the 80s and into the 90s, at the top basketball schools in America, Carolina, Georgetown, Duke, Kansas, Indiana, the coaches, Louisville, Kentucky, the coaches didn't allow any recruiting, like, whatsoever. And so, like, you know, if I said to Coach Smith, gosh, you know, I was driving down through Wilmington, North Carolina, and I bumped into Michael's mother at the food line, you're off the list. That was like one parking ticket, you're done. No letters, no phone calls, no nothing. And, you know, that's just the way it was. It was extremely disciplined. And so the relationship, you know, the relationship was very strong from an early age. I was trying to establish myself with him and prove to him that I could give him good advice, that I wasn't going to tell him what he wanted to hear. And he accepted that. And that was sort of the nature of our relationship.
David Falk joining us here on The Morning Show. And David, you mentioned that you've had hundreds of clients, and there was a really interesting moment in the documentary where you talked about Nike's aspirations on how many Air Jordans they wanted to sell over the first couple of years and how they just blew it away. Is that when you knew that not only was Michael a great player, but that this is something different, that he's resonating with people differently than all of my other clients?
Yeah, you know, it's just what it shows you, Keyshawn. Like, I use this following analogy. It's like, you know, I guess there are some people, including Kyrie Irving today, that thinks the world is flat. But, you know, prior to 1492, people thought the world was flat. You know, prior to 1984, there was a perception on Madison Avenue, particularly in basketball, that a team sport athlete could not expand beyond the boundaries of his team, beyond the Lakers, the Celtics, the Knicks, whatever, to become a national spokesperson. And particularly at the time, you know, the NBA, there was a perception that it was drug infested and that it was so heavily African American that the audience wouldn't accept a star to be a spokesperson. Magic didn't have Magic Johnson is one of the most charismatic athletes of all time. He's got a great name. He won the national title in 79 in college. And within a year, he won the Rookie of the Year, the NBA title, and the MVP. Now, that guy had a Hall of Fame career in a period of 12 months. But he had one national endorsement, you know, for 7-Up for 1 year. So people didn't believe that any athlete, had nothing to do with how talented you were, they just didn't believe that a team sport athlete could transcend. And the only guy that really did that in the entire era in that time was probably O.J. Simpson, who had a phenomenal, you know, career in marketing before he got in trouble. So when Nike came in and said they do this line, they knew they had to do it to get him. That was the condition. I said, if you don't want to give him a line, you know, you're a small company. If you don't show the hunger and the creativity that you could be more flexible than a big company like Converse or Adidas, you know, but that's your competitive advantage. So they agreed to do it, but they were skeptical. And so they wanted to have an out in the contract, not to terminate the deal. The deal was guaranteed for 5 years. And I love all the people guessing at the numbers. The number was north of $1 million a year at a time that Magic Johnson was making less than $100,000 a year. And as was Bird, and, you know, the only guy making north of 100 when Michael signed his deal was James Worthy with New Balance, who had the highest deal in the league at $150,000 a year. Michael made in excess of $1 million a year. And so they said, if we can't sell, first they came to me and said, David, we think this guy's going to be really good. Everyone tells us he's going to be good. But what happens if he's not as good as people think he is? I said, well, what do you mean? And they said, well, suppose he's not the Rookie of the Year. He doesn't make the All-Star team his first 3 years, or he doesn't score 20 points a game. We're paying all this money. I said, hey, if you don't think he can do that, don't sign him. And they said, well, can we stop making the shoe? We'll pay him all the money, but can we stop making the shoe? And I said, well, first of all, you're not a basketball team. You're a marketing company. What the hell do you care what his stats are? All you should care about is the shoe selling. The shoe selling, it doesn't matter if he's averaging 19 or 59. As long as it's selling, you're doing well. So they said, you're right. You're right. So they asked me for an out clause that if he didn't average 20 points a game, if he didn't make the All-Star team, and if he wasn't the Rookie of the Year in the first 3 years, they would continue the deal, but they could stop making the shoe and paying him a royalty. And the kickout clause was $3 million. They set that. I had no idea what their expectations were. And they thought that if they could sell $3 million between the third and fourth year of the deal, which is 87-88, that they'd be hitting a Grand Slam home run. And it wasn't like they could say, well, what did Magic do his first year? What did Bird do his first year? What did Kareem do his first year? there was zero precedence that they were just flying by the seat of their pants. And they picked the number, and in year one, we sold $126 million. I said this many times. Think about this. I would say that the Air Jordan deal, first of all, is the most successful athletic endorsement in the history of any sport. You know, it's a $3 billion company. It's twice as big as Under Armour's entire company today, just brand Jordan. And I would say it was the best deal I ever made. And I also say it was the worst deal I ever made, because if I had ESP and I knew they were going to sell $126 million, I would ask them to pay them $1 a year and go 50-50 on the royalties. That's what I would have done. But no one, the fact that Nike's expectations were $3 million, that they expected to sell, you know, 3% of what he's in year three of what he sold in year one, it just shows you like how incredibly impactful he was in, you know, in selling products. And the reason that I want to make this point, the reason I think there were many reasons that Michael was so impactful. You know, it was his style, it's his connectivity with the fans. But more than anything, Michael never set out to become a brand. You know, he set out to become a championship basketball player. And all his success flowed from the tremendous commitment, which you see in the movie, that he made every year to build up his body, to develop new moves, to psychologically dominate his teammates. Most young athletes today, and all these agencies that try to recruit him, the first thing they tell him is, we're going to build your brand. Now, 99.9% of these people are saying it to don't even have a brand, and they're never going to have a brand. But they get distracted by the TV and Sports Center and social media and marketing, and they never achieve on the court the kind of performance that they need to achieve to even think of having a brand.
The great David Falk joining us here on the morning show, former agent of Michael Jordan. David, let me ask you this, and you may or may not know, you mentioned the Godfather, you mentioned the power that Michael Jordan had. Michael has and had so much power in his playing day. You know, as I'm watching the documentary in episode 1 and 2, Michael, it seems to me, and maybe others, that Scottie Pippen had an issue with his contract, and Michael took issue with Scottie not having the surgery, but Michael didn't go, it seems as though he did not approach management about addressing Scottie's contract or his wingman's contract. Did he at all have any conversations that you know of with management about helping Scottie out and getting him a new contract so he can get on the court to help him win?
Yeah, let me respond to that. I apologize because I realized I didn't answer the other question. Michael's first contract was done by my boss at the time. I said I was 33. My boss was a guy named Donald Dell. He had a very strong relationship with Coach Smith. We got Michael because of Donald's relationship with Coach Smith, not because of mine. But what happened was I was the head of basketball. Donald's the chairman of the company and the founder. He was the captain of the Davis Cup team. He was a tennis guy. We go down to Carolina and meet James Worthy, Phil Ford, Michael Korn, Michael Jordan. And Coach Smith would recommend us. Donald did everyone's first contract. And after that, they called him the ghost. Like they said, you're gonna meet this guy. He's going to do your first deal. And this young bald guy you're going to meet, you know, named David. And he's going to do your shoe deals, he's going to do your car deals, your bank deals. He's going to take care of you day to day, and he's going to do every other. So Michael's first contract, which Donald didn't even consult me on. So if I give you a good, I know, Keyshawn, you don't know this, but I used to do football. You know, I've had, you know, James Lofton, Chris Dolman, Boomer Esiason, that's some pretty good football players. And it'd be like if you're on the one-yard line in the Super Bowl, this coach calls timeout, there's one play left, and off to the sideline, coach calls a play without asking the offensive coordinator his opinion of the play he's going to call. So I wasn't the head guy. I was the head of basketball. And Donald did this deal totally by himself. And it was probably, with the exception of maybe Magic's 25-year deal for $25 million, probably the worst deal in the history of basketball. And so Michael was behind the curve from the day he signed. It was a 7-year deal. And he got frustrated with the deal, as Scottie did. And I told him, you will never get paid what you're worth. unless you play the deal out and become a free agent. He wasn't willing to do that. So I negotiated a second deal. The highest paid player in the history of the league at the time was a rookie named Patrick Ewing, who I also represented, who's making $3 million a year. The second highest paid player was Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who's making $2 million a year. And I got Michael a five-year extension at $5 million a year. But it wasn't enough. And I knew when I signed it, it wasn't going to be enough. But Michael, you know, had broken his foot, and he didn't want to risk that, you know, something could happen, and he would, which is the exact motivation for Scotty. So Scotty, in the dock, this is what's so incredible. In the dock, Scotty explains that he had two people living in his home in Hamburg, Arkansas, that were in wheelchairs, that were disabled, and that he had to take care of these people. And he didn't want to risk that he was going to get hurt and not be able to take care of them. So he signed a long-term contract for what he thought was a lot of money that gave him the financial security to take care of his family. Now, financial security has a price. You know, when you lock yourself into a long deal, like Donald Bell did with Michael and Magic did with Dr. Tucker, you know, you don't have the flexibility if the market changes. You're locked in. And so Michael, biggest problem, and this is the one thing I think that Doc failed to bring out. You know, I love the part they had Rick Thielen, who's a great writer, on saying that Scotty was the 112th player in salary in the NBA. Now, back when he signed the deal, they didn't even keep those statistics. That's the current analytic. Scotty didn't give a damn if he was 112, 73, or 4. What bothered the hell out of him and really rankled him was that Jerry Krause, who was screaming for credit for putting this team together and was getting very little credit because he had the greatest player in the game and people thought that your next door neighbor could win a championship with Michael Jordan. He went out and found what he thought was his Michael Jordan, who was a young player in Europe, the best player in Europe, named Tony Kukoc. And he paid Kukoc probably double what he paid Pippen. That's what bugged Pippen to death. Now, Michael had many conversations behind the scenes about how foolish it was to do that and what the obvious psychological impact you're going to make on his wingman. But he had no power to stop the contract. And once Scotty got that deal, the owner, Jerry Reinsdorf, had a very strong policy against renegotiating contracts. And so while you're sympathetic for Scotty because he's making less than Kukoc, it's a decision that you make as a player when you sign. And that's why I tell my clients, if you want security, don't complain later if somebody passes you in salary. If you want to be flexible, sign a short-term deal. But if you get hurt, then don't come back and say you don't have security. You have to pick your poison, and it's very difficult. Now, the year after Michael was a rookie, I represented Patrick Ewing and got him the highest contract in the history of the NBA by 1.5 times. And I invented a thing which is now commonplace called the early termination option. Patrick had a 10-year deal, fully guaranteed for $32 million, compared to Magic's 25-year deal for $25 million, three times what Magic was making. And he had the right to terminate the contract after the sixth year in case the market changed. And sort of like Nike, when I asked the Knicks to give us this out, Dave DeBuscher, who is a wonderful guy, thought I was on crack. He said to me, David, you honestly think that anyone is going to remotely be making the kind of money we're giving Patrick Ewing? And I said, I really do. I think the market's going to change. And it did change. And we ended up redoing Patrick's contract. It went from $3 million a year to $12 million a year. Mm. So I'm sympathetic to Scotty, but, you know, you have to take responsibility for the decisions that you're making. And you can't always just blame it on management. Now, I think management was, Keyshawn, I think Jerry Krause wanted Kukoc to be his Jordan. He was searching for a guy. People said, wow, you found Kukoc. Now, it wasn't like he was a sleeper. He was the number one player in Europe. You know the guy Doncic who plays for Dallas? He was the Doncic of his day. Doncic is an incredibly gifted player. When he came to the Mavericks, he wasn't a sleeper. Everybody knew Doncic was dominating play in Europe. And Krause wanted a guy that people said, wow, very few people would sign a Euro guy like that. Now, Kukoc was a nice complimentary player on the Bulls. Michael's really good pals with him today. They golf together. He's a great guy. It wasn't his fault that Krause was so driven to have the credit for finding this guy. And, you know, he just wasn't that kind of a player. He was a nice offensive player, but he wasn't what Pippen was in any shape or form, and everyone knows that.
David Falk, Michael Jordan's agent, joining us here on The Morning Show. David, appreciate the stories. Appreciate the insight. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks, David. See you in Cabo, man.
A lot of fun. Let's tee him up in Cabo, my friend.
All right.
You got it. All right. David Falk right there. There's a whole bunch there, guys. We'll come back. We'll get into a whole bunch of the different things that David Falk said. That's coming up next on The Morning Show on 710 ESPN.
GEICO knows there are many reasons why you ride. From the camaraderie of the other bikers, a band of brothers, always there for you, rain or shine, to the amazing savings you get with GEICO on your motorcycle insurance and accessories coverage all year round. But for Bucky Hornhill, it was one reason in particular.
It was my helmet hair. I was born with helmet hair. I've tried to cut it a bunch of times, even buzzing it, but it immediately just goes back to helmet hair.
GEICO Motorcycle. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more.
All right, so Michael Jordan's agent, David Falk, just joined us a few minutes ago, and there's a whole bunch of stuff in there, guys. Let's start with this, because it really is kind of difficult, unless you really stop and think about it, to go back to what sports marketing looked like prior to Air Jordan. That there were some guys that had some things for sure, but Michael really did change the game with all of a sudden the Air Jordan brand, like he mentioned, it's three times the size of the entire Under Armour line at this point. That the vision that Michael had, and along with David Falk, had to decide that this is the way that they wanted to do this, to market a team sport player as an individual. In retrospect, it makes perfect sense, but at the time, it was kind of revolutionary.
Well, yeah, it is, and I think when you look at it, you know, obviously David worked for some other guys along the way, and Michael was part of a team, and those deals were being done by multiple people. David may have had, you know, he was the point person on those deals, and he certainly did a good job. Like you said, he's represented multiple NBA superstars, NFL players, sports players in general, where endorsements have come. When you have a guy like Michael Jordan who's doing the things that he's doing, certain people's eyes will open from a marketing standpoint. You get a guy like Phil Knight who sees a guy like Jordan who says, okay, this is a guy who certainly could take us to the next level if he continues to perform on the field, I mean on the court. Once they went to 120-something million shoes versus right. 3 million shoes, it was easy at that point. Because as long as he continued to be an all-star, the shoes was going to take off, and the personality was going to take off. But he is one thing I can tell you for sure he's right about, and as I've always said, Raj, and you know this, if you do what you're supposed to do on the field or the court, the rest will come to you. You can't put your celebrity before your play, or you're going to get hurt.
You know, it is interesting, you know, seeing how Michael Jordan, the brand, was groomed and was obviously sustained over all these years after playing. And, you know, Falk talked about his first boss, and his first boss was a tennis guy. That much is very true. But he took that tennis philosophy to Michael Jordan. Like a decade before Michael Jordan was even drafted, you know, Donald Dell, who was Falk's boss, had worked with Stan Smith to create the Stan Smith brand shoe. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of really where it started from in terms of that philosophy, where you take an outstanding athlete and you brand them beyond their sport. And as we know now, Stan Smith, very much like Air Jordans, are still being worn to this day.
But yeah, just got a fresh pair yesterday.
It was that philosophy that Donald Dell brought to the NBA, you know, that you can take Arthur Ashe and Stan Smith and you can make them more than just tennis marketers. You can make them marketers for the world. And when he got with Air Jordan, that combined with, you know, his great athleticism, that just took off.
And it was all of these things. And you're right. And Key, like you were saying, he needed to take care of his business on the basketball court first, because if that's not right, then nothing else is really going to matter. But there was also the perfect combination of incredible athletic achievements that Michael was putting up and just Michael's inherent charisma and magnetism, because there are other guys that have been great athletes along the way that don't have that kind of magnetism that Michael had. People were drawn to Michael in part because of he's a great player, but it was also his personality and his charisma that is impossible to find. You either have that or you don't, and Michael had it, and they hit it at the perfect time.
They certainly did, and you're right. There's guys, there's people that have it, and there's duplicates, but the duplicates will never amount to what Michael Jordan is. Kobe Bryant may have been the closest thing in terms of basketball to that. Even LeBron James, as great as LeBron is, it doesn't feel like he's that type of magnet that Michael was, or even Kobe to a degree. Was it just doesn't feel that way. He's big, but it doesn't feel as big as them two.
All right, so as promised, John Ireland is joining us right now. John, were you out on the driving range, the putting green? Are you getting some work in before we get ready to do our rematch a week from tomorrow?
Let me tell you something. If we were playing today, Travis, go ahead right now and pick your day off.
That bad, huh?
Yeah. Oh God. What 6 weeks off to the golf game is not good. That's what I've discovered. Pretty ugly. Well, ugly.
I feel like I'm being set up here. I'm usually the guy doing the setup, but I feel like I'm on the other end.
No. You'll see Travis, in living color.
I don't know you as a hustler. That doesn't sound right.
Yeah. No, not typically.
Yeah. By the way, can I comment on this? I don't know if you guys are done talking about it, but let me just say, this whole ESPN Fight Island thing that Sedano started, who are we kidding? Trav, I'll ask you first.
Yeah.
There's no way that doesn't end. None. Without Key versus LZ in the final. Everybody else is a windbag. these guys like Sedano and Bergman and Mason and all talking. Man, they don't go one round against Key or LZ.
Well, look. Here's what I would say. As I explained to the guys, and then I heard your take, John, I'm a pro, man.
Come on.
I'm a pro for a reason, and you're a sports talk journalist for a reason. It is what it is.
Amen.
Like, it's no disrespect. I mean, everybody got their lane, but when you start trying to cross over into other people's lanes, that's when you get your ass in trouble.
Key, I would argue that is the disrespect, that people just, like, completely forgot you, like, were the number one pick in the NFL. And
Well, you know what it is, though, John? You know, like a guy like George, love him to death. But he's regular. Like, he's regular when it comes to the sports world. And so because I'm on radio and I'm TV with you, you automatically think I'm regular now. You forget. And it doesn't work like that. I'm far from regular.
Yeah, and the thing is, you know, like, the idea that Clinton Yates calling in, like, he could get in the mix for this thing.
Man, Clinton Yates better go sit down somewhere.
That'd be a featherweight against Key or LZ. I mean,
Clinton Yates will run around and scream, "Ah, please stop!"
I could see LZ just standing in the ring laughing until Clinton got close enough and he would drop him in 3 seconds.
I would just offer him a book to read, actually. I wouldn't even want to do that to him. I was like, why don't we just read this book and just call it good so we can avoid all the blood? That's the reason why, John, I suggested doing something maybe less mano a mano and more internal, like a race or, you know, like right, something along... LZ, along that line.
LZ, with all due respect, a race? Keyshawn was 3 margaritas in and he beat Marcellus. And Marcellus played in the NFL. Key could run backwards in a race and beat us. What are you people looking at? This reminds me of the sport of boxing where they hype a bunch of tin cans until we can get to Ali Frazier. You know, I mean,
at the end of the day, I would probably say the only person out of everybody that's not delusional is you and Travis. Everybody else is delusional to me.
Really? And people are like Morales going, hey, you got to build up this fight thing. Build it up. It's fraud. what are we selling people? Is this absurd? Did he not watch TV from like 1995 to 2005? I mean, yeah, it just, anyway,
like Travis said, without even working out and sitting around one day in the office, I just jumped up on the desk just for.
So, John, just to give you an idea, in our studio, in the control room, right, where the producer sits in that back row,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Keyshawn, after just getting out of the chair, after sitting there for 4 hours, walks into that back room and just flat-footed jumps up onto the table and lands like a ninja. At that point, I'm like, oh, right. Yeah, he's the number one pick in the draft. That's right. I forgot.
I don't know what you people – and by the way, okay, the NFL, most people, even really great high school players, take off their pads for the last time after their last game in high school. If they're good enough, they can go to college and play a little bit in college, depending on how big they want to go. Everybody other than Key stopped hitting people 30 years ago. Okay? It's like what in the world are we selling to the people here? It's just a farce.
It is. But look, one of the things that I want to sell to the people is that basketball eventually will come back to Staples Center or even to a city near you, whether it's Orlando, whether it's Vegas. How far off are we from this happening, John?
Key, it kind of depends on when you would have asked me. If you would have asked me 2 weeks ago, I didn't think it looked great. I now think it does. The turning point for me was when you got the elite star players all in a room, and they were all on board, including Steph Curry, who really has nothing to play for. The Warriors aren't going to the playoffs. Their season is basically over. They would just be coming in to help out the other teams. And when Steph got on board, I thought, okay, if you've got Adam Silver and you've got the elite players in the league, you have the Chris Pauls, the LeBron James, the Anthony Davis, the Steph Currys, those guys will lead, and everybody else will follow. I just don't know, guys, exactly how it's going to play out. And the big thing we need, and this is the one thing I hear from everybody I talk to, is we need testing. We need to get the doctors on board, and they need to have the ability to test without taking the test away from people who need them, and they need to get quick results. Put that in conjunction with the thing that Adam Silver said, that if they get a positive test, it doesn't shut down the league. They have to have a plan for that like the UFC did last week. You check those three boxes, and I think they're going to get it back.
John, just shifting gears real quick. Tomorrow is the 40th anniversary of the 1980 NBA championship where Magic Johnson goes off for 14, 15, and 7. Where were you when they broadcasted that game? Did you see it live, or what? Did you see a tape delay?
I don't think they aired it live, LZ. I was in high school.
They did. They did air it live. It was in four cities, L.A., Philadelphia, Seattle, and Portland.
Yeah, I was I was at my friend Cindy Stoughton's house where we all used to hang out, and we watched the whole thing. And I thought the Lakers were going to lose that game because of no Kareem. I was the world's biggest Kareem fan. I thought he was the best player in the league even after Magic. Remember, that was Magic's rookie year. And that Magic just announced to everybody that, he's one of those guys. He's one of those guys that can carry a team to a championship all in one game. Because we all thought, okay, it's one thing to do it in college, to do it at Michigan State. But the NBA is a different animal. People forget, remember Magic didn't Larry Bird win Rookie of the Year?
He did.
Yeah, and so Magic was good, but that night he just flipped the script. He jumped center. He controlled everything, both with his passing and his scoring, and once you saw him do that to Dr. J and the Sixers, you knew that the Lakers were going to be around for the next 10 years, and they were. He went to 9 finals in that decade.
That's just remarkable, John. Before we let you go, just so we have it clear, we're doing our same wager that we did a year ago, that you and I are going to play golf a week from tomorrow at Black Gold out in Yorba Linda, and the winner has the day off, and the loser has to do double duty. You'll be in the morning, or I will be in the afternoon, and we'll both do our regular shows.
Yeah. Now, what day do you want me to come in the morning? Because
I don't like this setup. I've been around a long time.
I'm telling you right now, this is as easy as to predict as the ESPN Fight Island, the way I'm playing. But, Trav, I do have a week, so maybe I can find a miracle cure in a week for whatever it is that's making every one of my balls go out of bounds. So we'll see what happens.
Well, don't work too hard. Don't work too hard, because I could use the day. All right, John. Thanks. Appreciate it.
All right, have a good show. See ya.
Smart man, John.
Yeah, well, he's setting it up, Key. He's setting it up. He knows the fight is a joke, and he knows that anything else that he and I are going to do is that's the setup. Not that you would win the fight.
No. I mean the golf thing's a setup. Don't fall for the okie doke.
No, I'm not.
He'll come out there and shoot a 64 on you.
Well, no, I've seen him play. He's not going to do it. He's not going to drop a 64 on me. He could drop an 84 and win. That's a certain. That's absolutely a possibility. Week from Saturday out at Black Gold in Yorba Linda. Todd Gurley is in Atlanta, and one person in particular is thrilled to see him there. We'll get into that next on the morning show on 710 ESPN. So you guys know what happened 4 years ago today, 2016, May 15th, Major League Baseball. Any guesses?
I already know the answer, so I'm going to let Key go ahead and do it.
Key, any guess?
Somebody threw a no-hitter.
That actually happened. Nolan Ryan threw his first no-hitter of his career. He threw seven of them overall. That was 1973. But in 2016, one of the great baseball fights of all time took place when Jose Bautista is standing at second base looking at Rougned Odor, and Odor just dropped him with one punch. Bautista thought he was getting ready for a
baseball fight. At somebody getting sucker punched. Well,
No, it wasn't a sucker punch at all. Bautista slides into second base. They shove each other, and Bautista thinks we're going to do that thing where we're going to pretend we're about to fight. But Odor decided, okay, we're fighting. He went Ray John Rondo and just dropped him.
Hey, Travis, he knocked his sunglasses in the right field, man. He was just in there. He did the push. Oh, you go wait for everybody to break it up, right? Nope.
I think everybody understands now at this point you do not slide hard into second base or Odor is going to break your nose.
It's never happened since to Odor. Never happened since. And, guys, Travis, we also got some breaking news. As you learned earlier on the morning show, there's going to be a remake of Key's favorite movie, Scarface. Well, we asked the question, who's going to play Tony Montana? And the answer comes in from our friend Jonathan Watson on Twitter. He says, Michael B. Jordan has been casted to play Tony Montana.
Oh, no.
Michael B. Jordan. What do you guys think?
Well,
the sound bothers me.
I like Michael B. Jordan. He's a great actor, but I'm having a hard time seeing him in that role. That role, to me, feels like it's a role that's got to be a Latino role. That's me. Mm-hmm.
I'm more leaning toward Travis. It just
but Pacino
like,
isn't Latino, is he?
No, he's not. But
so there you
but
go.
He gave you a character and a visual.
How you know Jordan can't play a Puerto Rican or a Cuban dude?
Well,
know.
I guess he could.
Yeah, he could be Dominican. So he can be. Yeah, no question about it. But it don't. Because I've seen the other stuff already, I've seen Scarface 17,000 times, that it's already embedded in my skull, so it's going to be hard to get out.
Okay.
A whole bunch of brothers running around Miami, you know, you know what I'm saying? It ain't, you know, unless they got golds in their mouth and chains on and Versace clothes on, it ain't going to look right.
All right.
It's going to look right.
I'm fine with it. I'm fine with it. If you're going to cast Al Pacino,
I know you're fine with it. The Barbarian Brothers are doing it. I get it.
If you're going to be casting, you need fresh material. If you're going to be casting Al Pacino as a Cuban, and you're okay with it, then I'm okay with casting Michael B. Jordan as a Latino.
Yeah,
if
but you
he,
cast
if he plays
an Al Pacino,
Latino, that's fine.
You cast an Al Pacino as a Cuban. Back in those days, you didn't know if he was. You certainly didn't know if he was Cuban or not.
Yes, you did.
No, you didn't.
What are you talking about?
No, you didn't. No, you
didn't.
I didn't know until
a grown up.
Exactly. Until a grown up. Exactly. So stop. Stop.
His last name is Pacino.
Man, never mind. Never mind. Let's move on, man.
He also played in Carlito's Way. I was convinced. Okay, I'm Pacino.
Exactly. You didn't know that, man. You just learned that stuff recently.
His last name screams Italian. I don't even know what you're talking about. Pacino.
LZ, you brought it up a second ago, talking about the birth of Showtime. That was 40 years ago. Is it tomorrow? That Magic Johnson played center against the 76ers?
Yes. It was 40 years ago tomorrow, and it was on a tape delay for much of the country. As I was telling Ireland, L.A., Philadelphia, Seattle, and I believe Portland broadcast it live. Everybody else watch a rerun of Dynasty and the Dukes of Hazzard.
And where can we go? And where can we go today to find this, some of this information at, LZ?
it is all over the news. New York Post has written a story about it.
No, what did you write a story at?
Would you let me finish?
I'm just trying to get you a plug.
I don't need the plug. I just thought it was a fascinating conversation.
Well, I want to give you the plug.
Well, hold on.
He's trying to plug himself.
You can't make me get plugged. I'm going to tell you if I want the plug or not. The New York Post has written a story. I've written the story. Now, I think my story is better because I talked to literally everyone that was on the team in addition to talking to guys who were in the 76ers locker room. So I got Cap. I got Jerry West. I got Magic, of course. Silk is quoted. Michael Cooper. So I did a comprehensive piece, but I just thought it was fascinating that on the weekend that Michael Jordan's Last Dance is broadcast in the last two episodes, this is also the weekend that Magic Johnson got the Showtime era up and running.
Yeah. Reading your piece, LZ, the part that I think I knew it, but I had forgotten about it, that Magic decided to post up in Kareem's seat on the airplane. that as everybody started going by on the airplane saying, don't worry, Magic is here. Never fear, Magic is here. That this is a guy, a few months out of being on a college campus, that he was already that dude, that he was already Magic Johnson enough to say, you know, Kareem, even at that point, Kareem was in the conversation of the greatest basketball player ever. And then he just steps into that void as comfortably as he did, as confidently as he did. That, you know, in retrospect, it makes perfect sense because he's Magic Johnson. But he wasn't quite Magic Johnson then yet.
No, he wasn't. He wasn't the Magic that we've obviously had grown to know throughout the Lakers Showtime. But for any young kid to come into a pro sport and do what he did, although he didn't win the Rookie of the Year, but in a championship to perform at the level he was performing at, and I think he was averaging slightly
Points a game.
Yeah, slightly below 20 points a game, to have 40-plus in the rebounds and the assist and just the energy level that he was bringing was ridiculous. I mean, that just you just don't see stuff like that. Even the great guys in the NBA today that are one-and-dones, two-and-dones, go to the NBA, they not on fire their first year in the league.
No.
They cool. But you can't tell me one dude that you thought – oh yeah, he can lead his team to an NBA title that are coming out of college or high school basketball in 1 or 2 years. Not one guy.
Yeah, it certainly underestimates just how historic his performance was when you think about the way the key characterizes it. I mean, he was barely out of high school. And he wasn't playing against bums. We're talking about Dr. J, Mo Cheeks, Daryl Dawkins, and it's just absolutely amazing. You know, he's ranked as fifth in the ESPN poll, but that game alone, I think now he's top four.
Yeah, it's not a bad argument. Amin El Hassan joins us next. We'll get his thoughts on Fight Island. That's coming up next on The Morning Show on 710 ESPN.